All I can say is I'm not surprised. I used to work with Mike Duess, who also raised ethics a little while ago and was similarly, I think, possibly ignored by the profession after polite nodding. So hello, everybody. I'm Philip Barnes. I'm a patent attorney. I run my own practice, which is an interesting position to be in because both I sort of look at the business side of being a patent attorney as well as actually being a practitioner. So I've got some thoughts of this, and interestingly, not a published case, but I was involved in a case recently where there was some interesting moves made by the patent attorneys involved. So that sort of plays quite nicely into this theme. This is not, suspect, something that many people in this room will know much about unless you are actually a patent attorney yourself. So I'll sort of take you through it step by step. I put a question mark to make a point here. Are we or aren't we the gatekeepers to the IP system? Well, we are essentially the primary interface between most users of the IP system and the system itself. In quite a lot of cases, I think the patented trademark attorney is probably the only professional that gets involved in maybe 90%+ of IP matters, so filing a trademark, filing a patent application. And we are all regulated professionals with independent obligations. So I'll come on to exactly what these are in a second, but this makes it an interesting topic to discuss and exactly sort of what does that mean in practice. And so, you know, what do we actually do for our day-to-day jobs? So typically we would draft the patent specification, we would draft the numbers of claims and the specification for those claims for a trademark. We would put together the drawings and file those as the design application for a registered design. And I sort of note budget here, which is, I think, maybe where quite a lot of this comes from. There's a lot of commercial pressure from a variety of angles that maybe needs to be considered. And so I've got a few speculations later in my talk to keep this interesting. But one of the things that is worth mentioning is that UK IPO does not require you to have an attorney. Now, this is quite interesting. And the EPO makes it very difficult for you not to have an attorney, but technically you can avoid having one. So, you know, therein lies the landscape that we operate in. We do have to be sort of slightly respectful of the fact that, you know, some people just don't want to spend any money on things. And so we need to be sort of at that biting point of a sensible price for what we do. And to do that, you have to sometimes constrain what you actually can do realistically for some clients. So, you know, what bites here? What actually matters? Now, recently, I think 2022 or three, IPREG moved to what's called a principles-based approach to regulating how patent attorneys and trademark attorneys practice. And so what we have now are these eight very overarching principles, which are quite interesting. Now, these essentially are the ethical behaviors that IPREG expects all attorneys to uphold. And should any of these come into conflict with one another, then to safeguard the wider public interest, that will take precedence. That's what's meant to happen here. So if you look at these, you know, you're meant to act in a way that upholds the principle of the rule of law and proper administration of justice. And so, you know, this is where we're going with this. This is sort of the direction of travel. And so we'll look at some of the sort of examples that I was given to sort of write this talk and maybe try and actually apply some of these and see what should actually maybe really happen if we're sort of honest about it. And then we can think about, well, why maybe that doesn't always happen. So, you know, you could read that yourself. I won't read them out. Then we get on to what's called the code of conduct, which sits aside the general principles. And I pulled out just some excerpts here because I thought, you know, you don't need to read the whole thing. So, you know, one of the big ones is, you know, that we only do work that each individual is actually able to do, which might not need saying, but, you know, actually it is quite useful to be quite clear about this. Ignore most of 3.1, but the key thing I think it's worth saying is, you know, you're accountable for your work. And then, you know, any information that suggests there's been some sort of breach, you're meant to tell IPREG. And at the bottom, if it break, find out that you have done something that is supposedly not in keeping with the principles or the code of conduct, then they can, in fact, investigate you. And then, you know, you're meant to have professional indemnity insurance. So I've just dropped them in the middle. Now, interestingly, I think there have been two cases that IPREG have brought under the new, these sort of new regulations, these new principles and code of conduct, both of which are to do with 3.10. And I think for some reason, the attorneys either lapsed their insurance or didn't pay for it or something. I'm not entirely sure. I didn't look at the details. And so disappointingly, that means we've got absolutely no idea how they will apply these if the rubber actually hits the road. So that's very interesting. Now, the patent profession, certainly, because I sat on SEPA Council a while back, which is kind of the regulation board for the entire of the profession. It's like the union, let's call it, the patent attorney union, was always very proud of itself in that we got very, very few complaints as a profession. So it was generally perceived that, you know, we train people well and we do our jobs relatively well. But having looked at the last presentation, that's clearly not necessarily 100% true. So, okay, interesting. But you know, the question I think of this entire presentation is, does this actually have teeth? Well, does this actually change behavior? Does it really get taken into account? The other thing that we mustn't forget is that the EPI also regulates European patent attorneys. And so most UK patent attorneys are also European patent attorneys. And so there's a few, and even looser, as you can probably see, regulations for what European patent attorneys are expected. And so, you know, they're meant to be a reliable advisor. They're meant to act as an independent counselor, and they should give adequate care and attention and apply the necessary expertise. So, you know, these are all sort of very noble things, but they don't necessarily give very specific guidance on what you should or shouldn't necessarily do. So quite a lot of this is actually therefore left up to the individuals and the firms involved. And, you know, they are essentially lawyers and can quite happily argue for themselves and will do so. I thought I'd just throw in there that the EU IPO does European trademarks and designs, and technically you have to be registered with the EU IPO to practice as a practitioner in front of it. However, there are no rules for practitioners, interestingly. There is no code of conduct. There is no general principles. What essentially happens is that it is reliant on the national registrations of those individuals. So, for instance, a UK solicitor can apply to practice in front of the EU IPO, for example. Maybe not anymore after Brexit, but the point being that they would therefore be regulated by the SRA in the UK and sort of passport that into being able to represent in front of the EU IPO. And that sort of applies across Ireland and Germany, etc. And so, you know, what really bites here is essentially the IPREG rules, if you're regulated by IPREG in the UK, and if you're also an EPO representative, then the EPI rules technically. So that's what we've got to work with. We've got some very broad guidelines. Let's have a look at some of the abuses and just think about how those might actually apply and what, you know, I, as a patent attorney, might want to do, or if I were a trademark attorney, what would I do? Now, you know, the scenarios I was given, the first one, so obtaining a trademark registration with an overly broad specification or number of classes with no intention of use, and then we'll talk about filing a patent application and the knowledge of prejudicial prior art in a second. But I just thought, well, what would actually happen here? And where is there more play for abuse to actually happen? Now, what I would say is that where you're having an attorney actually involved with the client, so they've spoken to the client, they understand what the client does, they understand what they're planning to do commercially, the ideal model of what attorneys really want to do and what clients should probably actually ask for advice on, there you would get, you know, a nicely selected, balanced set of classes that fit with what they're actually going to do, plus a sensibly drafted specification for each class. Now, I would argue that in at least, you know, 99% of cases where this is the situation, then I think abuse is generally prevented by the gatekeeper, the trademark attorney, because they will want to do a good job and they will be aware of the code of conduct and the principles. And so therefore they will generally draft a sensible specification. There's no point drafting something where they have to tick a form saying, yes, this is what the client's going to be using it for, because they kind of know that's not the case. And so I think generally that sort of high margin, good client that takes advice and interacts with the process, I think that's generally a relatively safe bit of work. What becomes interesting, and I'll sort of lay this out in a slightly different way in the next slide, is the second situation where essentially you've got a sort of well-informed client and potentially a client that actually is set out to maybe abuse the system in some way. And they will sort of haggle on the price. They will scope the terms of engagement. They will provide just the right information to the attorney so that essentially it passes the sniff test, but actually maybe it is potentially abuse. They don't actually plan to use all the classes. It will, register me a trademark in these classes, register it with this specification. There, I think that's the gap. That's where the attorneys will have very limited recourse to actually go to the client other than to say, are you definitely sure this is exactly the specification you want? Yes, says the client that plans to abuse the system. Of course, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so, therein lies a potential problem, I would say. And then finally, interestingly, I think the extreme cases where a client comes in with like 14 classes with massive specifications, I think there the attorney will go, hang on a second, are you really sure you're actually going to do all of those things? And I think there actually you will find that you will get attorneys push back quite hard and say, I kind of don't believe that that's really what you want to do. And especially if they're saying, and I want you to do it for 3p and, blah, 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 and I'll pay you in 3 months' time. Then the client, that makes it a very easy decision for the attorney to hold up their hands and go, no, thanks, I don't want to represent you. So interestingly, the extremes, I've set this out on a different slide, the extremes of the sort of high touch and the sort of clients that want low touch, I think that's where abuse probably doesn't actually happen. I think the danger zone is very much in the middle, where it all looks on the face of it to be actually perfectly sound and fine. Okay, so that's sort of trademarks. Let's have a quick look at the patent situation. Now, this is sort of me and my day job more. So, we quite regularly get clients where they want to file a patent application. They explain what their invention is to us. It isn't a process that can be done with, here's a document, file me a patent application. It's very much more interactive. The patent attorney needs to understand what's going on in order to actually craft the claims properly. And to do that, takes a significant amount of time and also a significant amount of investment by the client. So, it is in everybody's best interests, in theory, to have that patent application be a good one. And so I think in the grand scheme of things, it's unlikely that the patent attorney will set out to write an abusive application. And also the clients will generally not want an abusive application because it won't really stand up to the process of the patent application. And we'll come to that in a second. Now, if an attorney is aware of detrimental prior art at the point where they're drafting the application, I would be extremely surprised if they didn't take that into account when actually drafting the application. I think I would say 99% of the time they would take that very much into account and draft the case very carefully to avoid that prior art, because there's literally no point otherwise in spending 10 hours of your life, plus probably more, writing a patent application well when you know that it's instantly invalid. There's just simply no point. It defies logic. But apart from anything else, clearly the IPREG standards apply here and clearly the EPI standards apply here. You've got to do a decent job for your client, and it's clearly a breach of that if you have just ignored detrimental prior art that you're aware of. Now, what's a lot more common is that the attorney just doesn't know about any detrimental prior art. A, they're not instructed to do a search before filing. I know some attorneys that will still secretly do a search just to double check, because they're like, I don't want to write a rubbish claim. I just want to have a vague idea of the prior art in an area that I don't know. most of the time, the attorney writing the application will probably be the one in the firm that actually knows about that subject matter anyway. So they'll have a broad understanding of what the prior art probably is. So I do think that, you know, it's likely that most claims are drafted well to start with and not in a way that would be some sort of ethical breach. And even if the client knows about some prior art and omits to tell the attorney that they've instructed and the attorney does their best job grafting it, the next thing that will happen is a search and examination by whichever IP office, at which point most likely that art will be found pretty quickly, especially if it's exactly the same. And so, you know, the system self-corrects to a certain degree with patents. Now, where I think I have detected problems in the past is, interestingly, where essentially one attorney hands it over to another attorney, somebody leaves a firm, different attorneys are working on different jurisdictions, maybe it's a large family of applications that should, in theory, share common bits of prior art for the same applicant, but people don't actually read each other's files, they don't talk to each other, they just get on with their thing, it gets done, they put it on the done pile, they move on to the next. So there's an element here to which you have to sort of say, well, okay, you know, humans are human and do make mistakes. But I do think generally patents are drafted much more carefully just because the money at stake is much higher. They've got more time to actually do the work properly. And I think, you know, the way that UK attorneys are trained is quite rigorous. And so just to sort of show this a little bit more in terms of patents, then trademarks, then designs, I think the patent system is kind of self-correcting to a certain degree. If you miss or you deliberately omit something prejudicial in filing the patent application, it should come up in prosecution, and then hopefully in theory it will be granted, having been adapted to get around that problem of some prejudicial prior art. So you've got the right claims in theory, or at least something that's arguably valid. The problem is, I think, if somebody makes a mistake or there is art that is maybe on something relevant but not the same application or in a different jurisdiction that gets missed somehow, or hopefully isn't deliberately ignored, but sometimes it must happen. So, you know, there's less wriggle room there. Now, the problem, I think, with trademarks and designs is essentially the system is not designed in the same way as patents because of the sort of cost-cutting approaches that we've applied to those rights to keep things reasonable for applicants. The system for designs is essentially you file it, it gets granted, as we discussed earlier in a different set of slides. And, you know, essentially it's on everybody else to challenge validity, which is not necessarily entirely fair, having represented a client on the other end of design infringement. Trademarks, similarly, you have to be watching to see what other people file in order to actually catch somebody trying to essentially rip off your trademark and oppose it. And so, you know, a lot of people are relatively lazy because they'll just file a few names that they're not sure about. They'll get opposed by people and go, oh, okay, well, those aren't any good, I'll just keep that one. So, you know, the system is kind of gamed based on how it's set up. And if somebody was a bad actor within it, it's harder in patents, but it's possible. And it's certainly much easier in designs, and to a degree it's easier in trademarks, except people are much more keen to watch things these days. Claiming ownership of IP rights is interesting. Now, I think registering designs for well-known products or a design that maybe isn't yours, you're just copying somebody else's. Now, I really struggle to find a rationale for attorneys that would actually get involved in this, because as soon as you're aware that design exists, there's essentially no point to doing the work. Now, again, designs tend to exist on a lower spectrum of costs, and so therefore attorneys can only charge so much. If they're getting involved, it's because it's an important design, and if it's an important design, again, you want something valid at the end of it. So therefore, I think, you know, where an attorney's actually involved in designs, I think generally the standards should be a bit higher in terms of they've actually checked there's some prior art, they understand what the individual character of each design is, they've got a case for why it's actually a valid design. That said, you know, I can absolutely see somebody building an AI system that just sort of rips off other people's designs, files speculative design applications, maybe even introduces very small changes to things to try and get a tiny bit of individual character and then build some sort of thicket. But I think, you know, I say this is probably a low risk of attorneys being involved in abuse of just ripping off other people's known designs. The only catch is if it's something that they're just not aware of being an existing design of somebody else's, and they just sort of go along with something that looks like a relatively straightforward thing that they're helping somebody with. So, you know, it's possible, but I think if they were aware of it, they wouldn't act. Now, abuse asserting and enforcing IP rights. This, I think, is the one I find hardest to believe attorneys would actually get involved with. Any infringement is insanely expensive for clients and has to be very justified. And any attorney worth his salt or her salt will be very keen not to bring litigation that is nonsense from the start. Because, you know, frankly, your insurers are not going to be very happy with you very quickly. Because the client will turn around almost instantly and say, well, it's your fault, you shouldn't have let me. And I'd say, fair enough. That's probably a fair assumption, actually. And so I find this one the most unlikely scenario. It must happen that invalid rights are asserted, but I would say that most people would at least have a fairly good argument as to why they think it is assertable before they go to the trouble of actually going to all the trouble of litigation and preparing all the pre-action stuff and then actually going to court. So I do struggle with this one because I just think that the money involved would be too much and the effort involved would be too much for attorneys to get involved in properly sort of abusive enforcement actions. That said, these are the ones that are going to be the most prominent because they're going to be the ones that are reported. So I think, you know, this is absolutely one that people probably most focus on. Whereas actually, I think the next one is absolutely the one that happens the most. I think, if I'm honest, I think this is probably the one that happens all the time and we just don't hear about it because it's shrouded in confidentiality agreements and nobody has any incentive to bring this up. So what am I talking about here? Well, this is where invalid IP rights remain on the register and potentially with some sort of agreement in place between parties where somebody says, well, look, that's clearly a rubbish patent. Why are you keeping that? And I think maybe the agreements based on an invalid IP right, that's going to be a much rarer thing. I have never actually come across that. I've heard people talk about it, but I've never actually come across that actually happening. And I think, you know, why do invalid IP rights stay on the register? Well, the simple answer is, do you really need an attorney to tell you whether you're going to renew something or not? Attorneys don't generally get involved in portfolio management anywhere near as much as they could. When I worked in-house for a large multinational company, they took a lot more effort to look at their portfolio regularly and actually prune things that they didn't need anymore or potentially had risks attached to it. Whereas I think, you know, smaller applicants represented by law firms just don't get involved in looking at how much it costs to decide whether to spend not very much money on a regular basis. And so I think, you know, a lot of invalid IP rights probably remain on the register because it's the easy decision. If you think about corporate responsibility internally, so governance internally, who sort of reports to who within a company, do you really want to be the person that abandoned a patent application or a patent that got granted because you thought, oh, okay, that doesn't look very valid or that's not a very good one? And then it turns out that that's really valuable. Answer, mostly nobody will make that decision. It's actually very, very hard to get somebody to decide to abandon a patent that has been granted and is on the face of it valid, even if it will save some money and they're not really using it anymore. It's like, oh, we might use it. Oh, it might come in useful in 5 years' time. And so I think generally, just to keep costs low, people tend to not get attorneys involved and not to raise that they've found some bit of prior art that actually might be terrible and not get the attorney to check if like a newer case in the same family to maybe some sort of improvement to the fundamental patent application actually found some prior art that invalidated it. So it becomes quite interesting because, you know, at what point does the attorney actually get involved enough to be able to say, that's invalid, you should drop it? I bet that not very many do. Also, you know, there's quite a lot of commercial pressure here. that, especially for in-house attorneys, where essentially they are pressured to take the easy option, just keep the patent there. We know it's invalid, just leave it alone. And potentially also, you know, when you find somebody else's patent, do you really want to go to the trouble of trying to revoke it and spending quite a lot of money potentially in the courts to do so, when you could actually just stay quiet and let them have it on the register with a sort of wink and a nod, say, well, we won't invalidate it if you don't sue us, done. I bet that happens more often than we're care to admit. Is it a breach of the IPREG rules? I think it probably is. Don't know. There are no IPREG cases either way, so we don't know where and how these get applied. I wouldn't necessarily want to be the attorney that made that call, though. So what is it that's the problem here? Well, I think the answer is there's a sort of balancing act here. There is the over-compliance with the code of conduct and the rules that might detriment your client, so you're not actually doing a good job. But then there's also trying to get maximum advantage, gaming the system, but actually you're also not doing your job there because you've sort of pushed it too far the other way. The attorney's essential worry is, have they balanced it correctly? Have they, you know, stayed within the code of conduct and the rules and the regulations, but have they also got sort of sufficient advantage for their client that kind of makes them worth the money that they're paid to actually do the work for that client? And then, of course, I can't help but finish on a quick AI slide. Apologies. as I keep saying, the robots are coming. I've drafted certainly more applications to do with it than I'd care to admit. And interestingly, the robots are actually coming because they're now putting AI onto the actual robots, saying, you know, watch this space. But I think what is interesting is, you know, AI has now got to the point where a relatively technically oriented person can probably build something that will do a lot of damage to the IP system if let loose, including, you know, as people have pointed out, the low cost of funding designs and being able to just sort of scour the internet, file those as applications. That could cause, you know, untold damage to the system, I think. So we'll see. Do I see a world in which the office has to do something about it? Probably. You know, do the fees go up? Do you make something more complicated about how you apply for these things? Do you place some sort of obligation on people to have an attorney, maybe? I don't know. It sort of feels like going backwards slightly, because having freed up people to be able to do their own thing, do we have to put attorneys back into it just to keep the AI slop out of the system? Maybe. Equally, AI might be brilliant and I won't have a job next year, in which case, you know, I'm available for public speaking appointments. Thank you for listening. Any questions?
Feel free to ask.
Just on that last one, I can't help wondering if we're going to go back to a world where wetted ink signatures on application forms are going to be required. But we will see. So I'm sure there's much to talk about, but we do have another break till 5:30, and then I hope we'll have some time at the end of the day for a bit broader discussion. So please be back for 3:30 sharp.